I'm Mark Simpson, and this is Intersection. December 21st, 2012 is this Friday. It marks the start of winter and the end of part of a more than 5,000-year-long calendar used by the ancient Maya. Some say it's when the world will end. I'll talk with an expert on Mayan culture about it. I'll also talk with an expert on asteroids about whether or not any of those heavenly bodies could be headed our way and whether or not they can be diverted. That's ahead on Intersection. If you haven't heard, I'm sorry to be the one to break the news to you. The world possibly ending this Friday. That's when more than 5,000-year-long calendar used by the Maya comes to an end. Some people think that day, December 21st, 2012, will bring the end of the world, possibly by an astronomical event, maybe something like an asteroid collision or some other change in the heavens. Other people think the day will mark the beginning of a new age of enlightenment. Others say it's just going to be a day like any other. For more about what this Friday might bring, I'm joined by Robert Sittler. He's a Stetson University professor and author of the book, The Living Maya, Ancient Wisdom in the Age of 2012. Robert, great to have you back with us.
Nice to be with you, Mark.
I'm also joined by Humberto Campins. He is a University of Central Florida professor and NASA asteroid expert. Humberto, great to have you with us.
My pleasure.
So, Robert, let's start with you. This date, December 21st, 2012, it marks the end of this long count calendar used by the Maya, but that's the ancient Maya, not currently being used. So why is this calendar significant, and how did this date grow this phenomenon that we see around it?
Well, that's a huge question. But to begin with, it's worth pointing out that, in fact, this coming Friday is not the end of the Maya calendar. It is simply the end of a massive cycle of time within that long count calendar, a little more than 5,125 years in length. And that, in fact, is coming to fruition this Friday. Some people might not know, I suppose, that this calendar fell into disuse probably 1,000 years ago in the Maya world. And the Maya themselves have only found out about, the living Maya, have only found out about this quite recently.
So the living Maya, those descendants of the ancient Maya, they weren't really aware of this phenomenon until recently. So how did they become aware of it, and how the heck did we become so obsessed with this?
Well, this is something that... let's start with the Maya, I suppose. The Maya, I started going down to talk with people specifically about this around 2005, 2006. And as I traveled around the Maya world, actually found zero people that had ever heard about the date. And I've been going back all over the Maya world since then. And on my most recent trip, that found that many people now do know about the date, primarily through these not very well done programs that have been put out by the History Channel. So they've heard a lot of doom and gloom concerning the date. In terms of our own development of this 2012 phenomenon here in the United States and elsewhere, this is something that actually began in the academic world. I think in 1951 was the first mention of this date since the 7th century, and it was by a woman academic at Vassar College in a note for a translation that she did. Most people, they'll really pin the blame, if you will, on Michael Coe, a very well-known Mayanist who, in his first edition of his book, The Maya, in 1966, mentioned that the close of this cycle could, for the ancient Maya, have been something that foretold some sort of calamity.
Well, take us inside it just a little bit more. Have the Maya accurately predicted previous world events in their calendars?
Actually, it wouldn't even be fair to ask that question because they rarely use dates in the future. The Maya left us a written record. This is the only civilization, really, from the Western Hemisphere that has a comprehensive literature. And in all those texts, there are only a handful of texts that refer to the future. They have only found, for instance, two dates thus far that refer to this 2012 cycle closing date, and only one date beyond that. So the ancient Maya were not into prophecy or into predicting the future, so it would be hard to say whether they came true or not.
A curse of the present, perhaps. Let's talk to Humberto Campins. Humberto, some people think that the world could end with an asteroid collision possibly on this date, and you're presently engaged in asteroid research with NASA, the European Space Agency, the Japanese Space Agency as well. What are the chances that this might happen?
Zero.
Zero.
That's an easy answer.
So why are people thinking about this?
I don't know, because the press keeps telling them that the world will end, so they'll look for some reason why the world must end, right? But no, right now, any asteroid large enough to cause global devastation has been cataloged, and it is not hitting the Earth, not only by December 21st, 2012, but right now there are no asteroids that are a hazard to global devastation. We have some that are potentially hazardous, that maybe in 100 or 200 years, their orbit is sufficiently uncertain that they could pose a threat in the future, but none of the asteroids that we have in our catalog, and we've cataloged basically all that can be cause global devastation, none of them are threatening Earth right now.
Now, not an interview that could face global devastation, but there is an asteroid predicted to pass close to the Earth in February. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, February 15th of 2013, Friday, at approximately 2:30 p.m., there will be an asteroid which is going to be about a half a block across that will pass between the Earth and the communication satellite, so between the Earth and the geostationary orbit. And it's going to be a great opportunity for us to study an asteroid close by. And as a matter of fact, at UCF, we're going to have an event from 1 to 3 in the afternoon at the Pegasus Ballroom at the Union at UCF on Friday, February 15th, so that we can watch this real time as the asteroid approaches Earth and moves away. Now, it'll be daytime here, but it'll be nighttime in Europe, and we'll have direct feeds from telescopes in Spain, so we're going to be able to witness this. But that one is not going to hit Earth.
And the name of this asteroid?
It doesn't have a name. It's right now has a designation. It's 2012 DA14. We give such poetic names to asteroids, don't we?
Everyone, mark that down so you can put it in
2012 DA14.
In your planners. An asteroid passing so close to the Earth, are there possible ill effects or measurable effects on the planet?
The measurable effects is that we're going to be very interested in looking at this asteroid close by and learning more about it, so that if in the future it had to be deflected for some reason, we would do that. But it is now in a very well-determined orbit that will come nearby, but it's not going to hit.
Is it tough to observe in Florida? I was going to ask it. There's like so much light pollution.
That,
right?
That is correct, and we're also at sea level, essentially. The highest point, the highest natural point in Florida, I think it's like, 170 or 200 feet. And the highest point in Florida is the top of the vehicle assembly building at the Kennedy Space.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
It's the VAB?
Yeah, that's the highest point in the whole state. But the highest natural point is somewhere in the border with Alabama. And that's going uphill. But what I was going to say is we're nearly at sea level, and our humidity tends to be high. So in the winter months, our telescope, for example, on campus at the Robinson Observatory, does pretty well. In the summer, it's harder. But we use that telescope to do mostly public outreach and for the use of our students. But we also use it for some science, because since we have lots of time on it, we can monitor these asteroids and determine whether they're binary, and that's a very interesting thing to do. We other do monitoring of variable stars. But most of my research gets done from telescopes in orbit, like the Hubble Space Telescope, the Spitzer Space Telescope, and from telescopes in Arizona, Hawaii, and the Canary Islands.
Now, I've heard there's been a lot of conversation with known astrophysicist folks like Neil deGrasse Tyson about another asteroid, Apophis. When does that asteroid come into play, and how is that different than the one you're looking at in February?
Apophis is a larger asteroid, and for a while we thought that it could come between the Earth and the Moon into such an orbit, a place what we call a keyhole. If it went through that keyhole, it would go into a resonance and it would hit Earth about 7 years later. But that is not the case either. But for a while, there was quite a bit of interest. There's still interest in following Apophis because it could enter into one of these resonances. But we know that on the next pass, it will not do that. So Apophis is, again, not a threat.
And when is that asteroid expected to come close?
It comes close about every 7 years. So we had a close pass of it about 3 years ago.
So Robert Sittler, jump in with me as we talk about big things happening possibly to the planet. Some people thinking that there could be a polar shift or some other strange alignment in the heavens. As you look at this 2012 phenomenon, any credence that you see to those theories?
Well, there are two things that I would refer to. One is, this is kind of ironic because I go around telling audiences not to worry about 2012. The world is not going to end. And I will continue to do that until this coming Friday. But as I'm saying that, it frequently occurs to me that due to environmental degradation on numerous levels, the world, and I want to phrase this very carefully, the world that we humans have known since the dawn of our species already is ending, or if you follow Bill McGibbon's work, already has ended. You look at climate change, you look at species loss, you look at soil erosion, you look at tropical forest loss, and we could make a huge list. These are unprecedented changes, all due to human activities. So it's kind of funny, you know, yeah, the world's not ending on Friday, but the world in a way is ending. It's also worthwhile in terms of astronomy, or maybe I should say astrology in this context, there is a lot of talk about this galactic alignment. That is probably one of the main themes in the 2012 phenomenon. And in fact, the Earth, the Sun, and pretty close to the center of our galaxy will be in alignment this coming Friday. What people really don't talk about and most don't know about is that that alignment takes place every year. It's not that extraordinary.
Well, let's bring Humberto into the conversation. You deal with the heavens on a regular basis. What can you tell us about this galactic alignment?
I agree with Robert completely. That actually, if you consider that it doesn't matter on which side of the earth, of the sun the earth is, that alignment happens twice a year. And it's been happening twice a year, and the world has not come to an end. But I have to let me put this into a little bit of perspective. Apocalyptic tales have been around since before Christ. And it's for some reason, humanity just loves to latch on to these. But we have to be careful. A colleague of mine, David Morrison, at the NASA Ames Research Center in California, he is an astrobiologist, and he has this blog, and he receives a lot of email. And he was saying that he's actually very concerned and torn because he's getting emails from children that are saying that they're very worried about the end of the world, and they're preparing to die, and how to put down their dog or cat so that they don't suffer during the end of the world on Friday the 21st. So we need to make sure that the reporting of this is done responsibly. And we need to emphasize the world is not ending because of any natural cause on the 21st of the month.
Talk to me about how this creeps into your own life, your own research as a scientist dealing with this. Obviously, we know that there's connections with massive bodies coming in from space, an asteroid believed to have wiped out the dinosaurs. So there is precedent for mass extinctions happening on this planet. But as you look at asteroids and you see the media surge around this 2012 phenomenon, how does this resonate in your own professional community?
Well, as a matter of fact, one of the reasons why NASA approved the mission that I'm on, called OSIRIS-REx, to go to an asteroid and pick up a sample and bring it back to Earth, the main reason is a scientific one, but a non-trivial secondary reason is that this asteroid could be a potentially hazardous asteroid. Also, it is a potentially hazardous asteroid. In the future, in another 170 years, this asteroid, the orbit is sufficiently uncertain that it could threaten Earth. So we're being funded in part to make sure that we characterize this asteroid, and if it becomes a threat, we nudge it out of the way so that it does not impact Earth. But impacts like that, Earth has been hit by asteroids many times, and one of the largest impacts is the one 65 million years ago that created such a large climatic change that it wiped out two-thirds of the species, including the dinosaurs. And so that has happened, and that will happen. But an event that large only happens every 1 to 3 million years on average. And we don't know exactly when it will happen. That's why we've done this study, this survey of all the asteroids that could do this. And so it's not happening anytime soon. So the chances of something like that happening during our lifetime is so small that we should not worry about it as individuals. However, as a civilization, the consequences of such an impact are so large that as a civilization, we should. So we're planning for an event that is very unlikely but has such strong consequences that if it does happen or if it's going to happen, we can avoid it.
We're talking about the 2012 phenomenon on Intersection this week. You're listening on 90.7 WMFE-FM in Orlando. Our guests are Umberto Campins. He's an asteroid expert at the University of Central Florida. We're also joined by Stetson University's Robert Sittler, author of the book, The Living Maya, Ancient Wisdom in the Age of 2012. What do you think is going to happen at the end of the week? You can tell us. Go online to Facebook or Twitter, and you can also send us an email to wmfe.org/intersection. Umberto, talk to me about how you actually would move an asteroid out of a dangerous trajectory. Do we know how to do that yet?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question. It depends on what the asteroid's structure is. If it's a single rock, if it's a monolith, it's relatively easy to just attach a rocket to it and push it out of the way. But if it's a rubble pile, which is what most asteroids are like.
Like a cluster of debris.
Yeah, it's debris that is being held together by the very light gravity that all these pieces pull, you know, they pull on each other, which is what the majority of the asteroids are. So we, in that case, we need to nudge them out of the way very, very gently so that we don't create a shower of impacts instead of a single impact. And that, so there are a number of techniques that have been proposed. A solar sail is one of them, so that you attach this very large surface that will reflect sunlight and nudge the asteroid slowly. Or a gravity tractor, you place a spacecraft on next to the asteroid, so the gravity from the spacecraft pulls it slowly out of its way. And there are other more dramatic techniques that have been proposed, but it depends very much on the structure of the asteroid. So that's one of the reasons why we're going to this asteroid, 1999 RQ36, to study it, characterize it. So if in case in within the next 170 years we need to move it out of the way, we'll know how to.
When you talk about attaching a rocket, how big are you talking? Is it something like a space shuttle solid rocket booster or a Saturn V size? How big are we talking?
Depends on the size of the asteroid and depends on how quickly you need to move it out of the way. If we get a 2-month notice that this thing is hitting us, we better put a very big, a very big push on it to move it out of the way. If we know it might hit us in another 100 years and we have 100 years to change its orbit, then you can just do that with maybe a very small impulse.
Now talk to me about the amount of lead time you get on something like this. How far out do you know that these big objects are getting close to the Earth?
The large ones that are capable of global devastation are relatively easy to pick up because they reflect a lot of sunlight, and therefore we know we have those categorized rather well. We're going into a second stage of this survey where we're categorizing things that are small enough to make it through the atmosphere. In other words, they wouldn't completely burn up in the atmosphere and could cause if they had a direct hit on a city, they could cause sufficient damage that way. So right now we have everything that is large enough to wipe out civilization categorized, and those are not hitting us.
Do you ever have a moment when an asteroid does crop up and you say, hey, we didn't know that was there?
Well, that happens all the time.
And it's close, I guess, I wonder.
And yes, but that tends to be with small ones. And for example, 2012 DA14 was discovered early in this year, and it will come closest to us on February 15th of 2013. But this one is half a block. And so if it were to hit, which it will not, the probabilities of that one hitting are zero. But if it were to hit, it most likely hit in the ocean, not cause any damage. Or since it's coming from the south, it could have even hit Antarctica. So it's not a concern, this one. But so we're going into, we're expanding our knowledge of these things with the next generation of surveys where we would be able to predict something like this hitting us and be able to deflect it eventually.
Robert, we heard Umberto talking about the psychological impact, stress even, of these end-of-the-world scenarios that seem to come in cycles. And in your research, you've seen that there's maybe a cultural difference between the Maya today and Westerners who get fixated on these big end-of-the-world theories. And your research has shown maybe that the Maya psychological profile is they're doing better than us.
Yes, I think there are some very practical dimensions in the lives of many Maya. You know, we're talking about an extremely diverse group of people that speak 30 different languages, so you don't want to get too carried away with generalizations. But the people I interact with the most are people that live out in the country who are growing corn for their families and are living their lives out of doors. So their context is far broader, surprisingly, than our own. They're outside. They look up at the sky every night. Their individual lives, while they understand they're important to them and their family, are minuscule in this vast context. And that has informed those societies for many centuries. And strangely, so when they hear about potential end of the world, there's a sense, well, that could happen. And they go back to work.
And how has the 2012 phenomenon impacted Maya culture today? I've heard some recent stories about people using this as a business opportunity.
Yes, the business opportunities, unfortunately for the Maya, are not ones that they have been able to take advantage of. There are many tour operators in that region who are not Maya who will be making some money off of this. Maya spiritual guides, in Guatemala at least, have organized a number of events for the day around the country at sacred sites, at their ancient ruins. So that's how at least a few people will be celebrating. But broadly, I would say, even as we're speaking right now, the vast majority of people that we would call Maya, they don't even use that term to talk about themselves, still do not even know about this date.
Robert Shetler, you had an interesting observation. As we talk about 2012 and asteroids, the confluence of events, down in the Yucatan, there's a massive impact crater there, surprisingly, from an asteroid, right?
Yes, this is one of the odd, I guess, coincidences of these times where this massive impact that changed life on Earth as we know it 65 million years ago, Umberto saying, actually happened in the Maya world. It's just bizarre.
An interesting coincidence. What do we know about that impact, Umberto?
It's a very interesting story about how it got determined. But for a while, astronomers had suspected that there was a big impact site because they had found evidence of it in other places around the world, and it pointed towards the Caribbean. Eventually, it was discovered that it's half underground and half under the ocean floor, centered more or less near Cancun. So the impact happened to where Cancun is now. That is Maya world now, but back then, humans were far from existing, right? The most advanced mammals at the time were like muskrats. So we as a species, we didn't exist, but it happened there. And then that created such a dramatic change in the weather that 2/3 of the species, including the dinosaurs, were extinct.
But it did end up eventually evolving into a very nice tropical area, as we know Cancun to be today.
Indeed. And nope. Cultural.
And cultural.
Yeah, you have Chichen Itza not far away.
I guess you're
you have
right, yeah.
Tulum, which is the only, if Robert, correct me if I'm wrong, but it's the only imperial Mayan city on the ocean.
The only thing of that size, right? Yes. So it was definitely a trading center. I mean, the Mayas, as you know very well, Umberto, were great observers of the sky, and for their time, the classic Maya were tracking all sorts of astronomical phenomena. And even today, just because of what I said earlier about people living outside, most people are familiar with basic features of the night sky, unlike here. And again, this is just a practical result of being out at night and looking around.
I guess it's well known that the Mayan calendar was considerably more accurate than the European calendar when the Europeans got to the New World. So, and the Mayan, for example, used Venus as one of the ways to keep their calendar on track. And so it's fascinating how much these people were aware and were able to use that information for their own benefit.
How likely do you think it is? There's a lot of talk right now about possibly being able to mine asteroids for valuable minerals.
That's very likely. It's interesting, for example, platinum. All the platinum on the surface of the Earth comes from impacts with asteroids. So it's old impact sites that get mined for the platinum. And on the moon, the surface of the moon is just the debris from many, many impacts over billions of years. So you can process lunar material and take out the platinum, and that would more than pay for the cost of going to the moon and bringing back the material. And similarly to asteroids. The good thing about asteroids is that you can actually get to them and come back to the Earth with relatively little energy because they have orbits that come relatively close to Earth. So the difference in velocity to change from one orbit to the other one is small. So you can go to this these asteroids that have almost no gravity, pick up material, and then bring it back to Earth's orbit, process it there, and then send down the platinum to Earth. But platinum is just one of the examples. There are a number of other things that are strategically important and that are very useful to industry that we can find there that in the case of the Earth is much harder to find because, remember, the Earth heated up and melted. So the heavier material went to the core, the lighter material floated. And it's only when you have very strong volcanic processes that bring some of that material to the surface that you can actually mine them. But if you can go to objects that never melted and they have this material throughout their mass, then you can process that either in space or in Earth orbit, and in deep space or in Earth orbit, and then you can extract it at much lower cost. So right now there are a number of private enterprises that are planning on capturing asteroids and processing them. Plus, there's the interest from the space agencies of the different countries that have this capability.
That was going to be my question, is how far off is the technology to do that?
I would say no more than 10 years. So we would be benefiting by bringing material down from space, I'd say, within 10 or 15 years.
So I've got to ask you, Umberto, that famous asteroid scene, Empire Strikes Back, where they're whizzing through the asteroid field, how real is that?
Yeah, that could be quite real. I mean, you could have an asteroid field where you have all these more or less irregular shaped objects because they've been shaped by impacts. And it wouldn't be as spatially dense as in the movie, but you could have a distribution of objects that are more or less strangely shaped, and you could be zooming through them.
So even the asteroid belt that's between Mars and Jupiter, you're saying it's not that dense. When we send probes through there, it's not like that.
We
it's not
have like to so. Make a big effort when we're sending probes to Jupiter and Saturn that are going to cross the asteroid belt. We have to make a big effort for them to come close to asteroids to study them. Otherwise, it's just mostly empty space. So there are lots of asteroids, but the asteroids are small and the volume is large. So the number of asteroids per unit volume is very low.
Umberto, you actually have had a conversation with some Maya recently. What did they tell you about this 2012 phenomenon?
Well, last week, by coincidence, I was talking to somebody who's Maya, and he lives in the area near Cancun in Mexico. And he said, listen, it's very interesting because our civilization did not last 5,000 years. We lasted like 1,800. Robert will be able to correct me if I'm wrong on that. And he said, we inherited our calendar from a previous civilization. And so it's not that this is not our calendar. It's something that we refined. And we do not predict the end of the world. We do not, we are not worried about this date. But we do see a deterioration in our environment, and we are trying to send that message out. We're using this opportunity to send that message out.
Just to follow up on that, I've made a point of talking to as many Maya spiritual guides as I could in that part of the world for the past few years, and that is the consistent theme I hear from them as well, that human beings have not shown sufficient respect to the Earth, and what we're seeing right now is a natural consequence of that. So they put this idea of 2012, they say, well, only God knows, solo Dios sabe, what's actually going to happen. But their sense is the best use of this time is a time of reflection upon how we live our lives.
Well, I think that's a great note to leave things on. We've been talking with Robert Sittler. He's the author of The Living Maya, Ancient Wisdom in the Age of 2012, and a professor at Stetson University. We're also joined by Umberto Campins, who is an asteroid expert at the University of Central Florida. Gentlemen, thank you both for sharing your insights.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
The conversation about what's happening in Florida continues online. Visit WMFE.org/intersection to find out more. There you can always sign up for our weekly podcast. Support for Intersection comes from our listeners. Amy Green is assistant producer. I'm Mark Simpson, and thanks for listening.